No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight we have a special guest. We have with us former D.C. Council member Jack Evans. Jack, one of the most experienced legislators in the District of Columbia, was first elected to the Council of the District in a 1991 special election and then reelected in 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008. Jack was elected to be the chair pro temp, vice chair of the D.C. Council. He's worked in D.C. politics and also in national politics, which includes the 1992, 96, and 2000 Democratic National Conventions, being the Howard Dean D.C. co-chair, as well as Bill Clinton's D.C. co-chair, Hillary Clinton's D.C. co-chair, and the D.C. Party, Democratic Party treasurer. Jack's done it all. We're happy to have him on the show. He's an old friend. He often stood up for our delegation, and we appreciate that. Jack, welcome back to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor for me to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's just start out at the top, since you have so much experience in national politics, and this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Let's talk about Donald Trump for a minute. You know, Jack, I started in Democratic politics at the national level in 1980, done a lot of the same things that you've done, but at a much lower level. I was a DNC staffer. I've been to 13 consecutive conventions, worked on several presidential campaigns, and this took me by surprise. I must say, I never thought that he would get reelected. What do you think our problem as Democrats has been? Is it was it just that we didn't have enough time, that we didn't, you know, that it was such a convoluted election period, only 10 weeks between the time we got our nominee situated and the election? Or is there something that the Democrats are missing?
Well, Michael, thank you again, and thank you for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and talk to the residents of the District of Columbia and others about the issues facing us. And but the election, I was a big Kamala Harris supporter, voted for her, at the end thought she was going to win, and it was a big disappointment, I know, to all of us that she was unsuccessful. She did, as a candidate, I think the best that she could possibly have done. I think she came in late, as you know, and she campaigned hard and really did as good a job as anyone could have asked her to do. I think, though, there's more than one reason that she didn't win. Some you just mentioned. There wasn't a lot of time. As a vice president, she wasn't all that well known, which is not uncommon for vice presidents, and she had to go out and make her message. And Donald Trump, again, he is a very controversial figure. Obviously, people like him, don't like him. But if he is one thing, he is a salesman, and he's been doing this for his entire life. He's taken a name, a brand, Trump, and made it into a high-end brand name. That's what he does, and he's quite good at it. And I think he was a formidable candidate. And I think going beyond that, too, the obviously the issues that people are concerned about, the inflation, or the, I take it differently, it was the high price of things that was a result, not necessarily Joe Biden, but it was the Trump and the Biden policies at the pandemic, and no fault to them. They did what they thought was right to pump money into the economy. It pushed prices up, and then you had, of course, the shortages that also pushed it up. And people, you know, they looked at what the prices were on this on the election day, not putting a lot of thought into why they got there and the fact that inflation was down and things, the economy was booming. That was kind of lost on a lot of people who, you know, rightly so, were paying a lot more for the price of eggs than they wanted to. And the border stuff, the immigration stuff, there were a lot of issues, I think, that that the party was grappling with. Somebody said this, and maybe it's right or wrong, but the mood of the country was not positive, and Trump is the alternative, and he won. And it was a close election in many ways. He did, on the Electoral College, do quite well. But most of those seven states were, you know, 1, 2, 3% could have gone either way. So it wasn't like we got wiped out, but we did get beat. Right. He is the president. And going forward, we have to figure out what to do.
Well, you know, I remember in 1980, and you probably remember this too.
Sure.
I worked for Jimmy Carter, and I remember election night, and it was the same kind of disappointment. We lost the Senate, we lost the House, we lost the presidency, but, you know, the difference being we lost to Ronald Reagan, we didn't lose to a maniac, and he didn't have the Supreme Court in his pocket. So so woe is me. Yeah, I think that people that have been around for a while, like you and I, Jack, realize that he also went for the lowest common denominator. It's the oldest thing in politics, right?
Sure.
Hate your
sure.
neighbor, be a sexist, be a racist. He played all those cards, and it's a shame. Well, let's talk for a minute about what we can expect in the District of Columbia, because this is the big, big thing that's out there, right? He's vowed to take over the District of Columbia. You were actually on the city council when the control board came in. And for people that don't understand this, people that might be listening, the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says that Congress can exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district. That really means that they can do any damn thing they want. So they took over the district with the control board. First of all, what was that like? You were on the council. What did the council do? What did they have to do when the control board was in control?
Yeah. Well, I'll back up a little bit to when I first got elected in 1991. The city and the country in 91, 92 were in a huge economic crisis. It was the time, if you remember, when George Bush was running for re-election and Bill Clinton beat him, and the famous comment by James Carville was, it's the economy stupid.
The economy stupid, yep.
Right? And that's what Clinton ran on, and the economy was in a slump, and Clinton won. And the economy in the district was really in the tank. And so then the government itself was somewhat unwilling, I would say, to make some of the hard decisions that needed to be made to keep the district solvent. I remember being on the council with, there were three other new members, Kevin Chavis, Harold Brazil, and Bill Lightfoot. You would remember them, and Linda Kraft.
Yeah, of course.
And they called us the Young Turks, because we were young back then, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
And, you know, our approach was, oh, we need to, you know, make cuts, we need to do changes, and there was not a consensus, a majority on the council who wanted to go in that direction. So I say that as some preface, because in 91, 92, 93, the financials unraveled here in the city because of the economy and overspending, and by 1994, 95, the city was in a huge financial crisis. Sharon Kelly was the mayor, and she then lost to Marion Barry, who took over in the beginning of 1995. And again, the finances were about, I'd say, $800 million in debt. In today's numbers, that would be well over $1.5 billion. And there was no way for the city to make up that type of a shortfall. So the control board, we call it, but it was actually a financial authority. And it was put in place because I remember this because I was the finance involved in the finances. We could no longer borrow money from the Treasury. They wouldn't loan us money, so we were not able to finance our government, not able to pay things. And the control board was put in place to manage our finances. So that's what brought it in. So the mood of the city was, on the one hand, you know, oh my gosh, we're losing our home rule. But on the other hand, there was really no other option for the city to survive financially. And so Dr. Bremer and I remember Connie Newman, Joyce Ladner, Steve Harlan, Ed Singletary, I think those were the five members of the board that were appointed by President Clinton. And also remember, this was a bipartisan effort. It wasn't just the Republicans were imposing this on us. President Clinton was the president. Frank Raines, I believe, was his finance guy. And these were all local people who were very concerned about the city. So the control board came in and reorganized our finances. And at the same time, and I want to be too long-winded on this, but we went through something called the act that reconstructed our finances. And if you remember, we gave up the Lorton prison and went into the federal system. But the biggest one was our unfunded pension liability, which had reached $10 billion. It was really going to assume everything in the district, all the money we were raising. And the federal government agreed to take that in return for giving up the land over at Lorton. It was called the Revitalization Act and a number of other things. And it really right-sided the finances of the District of Columbia. And at the same time, the control board had extreme powers over all the agencies. I think Marion only had the rec department. And I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee at that time on the council and worked closely with the board. We hired a new police chief, Chuck Ramsey, out of Chicago. Again, if you remember 94, 95, we had 500 homicides. We were the murder capital of the country. Reorganized the police department in its entirety to the system we have today, the PSA system. And so a number of really important actions were taken. And again, the control board made decisions that the local government would not have made. And that was the value that they brought. And at the end of the day, and remember, our finance person on the control board was none other than Tony Williams. And he went on to become the next mayor after Marion. And so that's what we were dealing with. And the end result was a very positive one for the city. We came out of that situation in a much stronger financial and in many ways, much stronger financial and operating city.
Well, I don't think, I don't think there's going to be anybody, if there's a new control board, there's not going to be anybody like Joyce Ladner or Alice Rivlin,
right,
or, you know, any of those other people, right? So it's going to be a whole different experience. But was the council, did the council have a function under the control board or not? I mean, could you pass laws still? And
yep,
it was just about the finances.
The control board had the ability to stop anything we did, but we functioned as a council. We passed laws. If control board disagreed with that, they could have stopped it. But for the most part, we worked in conjunction with them. And you raised some other important names. Alice Rivlin was a real hero because she was the second head of the control board after Dr. Bremer stepped down. And Alice's goal was to get rid of the control board. And so she worked very closely with all of us on the council. Again, Linda Kropp was a real hero. She was chairman of the council. Tony Williams was the mayor. I was the finance chair. Nat Gandhi was the CFO. And we were able to work our way out of the control board years ahead of time. So that I'd say, you know, 2002, 2003, somewhere in that area, the control board went away. And so it was, again, when the control board was here, the city pretty much operated like it did prior to that time, but we had an extra layer. Maybe that's the best way of describing it, an extra layer of oversight that we had to work with. And it worked out. Again, I look back on those days. There were difficult days for the city, but at the end of the exercise, we were financially in tremendous shape to begin the recovery of the city. And I remember, I think in 2000, well, it was really 1999, we all started going up to Wall Street. We had a B-minus rating for the city. I mean, you couldn't get any lower than where we were at that point in time. And over that course of time, we ended up in 2018 getting a AAA-rated bond rating. And that's an extraordinary trip for a city to take from being really bankrupt to being AAA rated. So the exercise proved to be a positive for the city. But what we're dealing with now, Mike, and I could just keep going on this in a sense.
Yeah, please.
What we're dealing with the Trump administration is vastly different. The city's finances are still very strong. I mean, we have some issues of spending maybe more than we should be and everything, but it's nothing like it was in back in the 1995 period. We still have an independent CFO and things of that nature. So our finances are very strong. And overall, the city's doing fine. I mean, the economy is recovering. I think Mayor Bowser is doing a great job, and she's really been a good leader. The council gets out there a little bit on some of these issues that are not necessarily well-received in Congress. And I think they're learning their lesson not to do that, having been kind of slapped down last year on that criminal code. So I think if everybody kind of, you know, keeps their head down and tries not to poke the bear, so to speak, I think we have a good chance of being able to work with the incoming administration.
I hope you're right about that. I grew up in North New Jersey, Jack, in a bad neighborhood, and I never, ever in my life met a bully that responded to any kind of capitulation or cooperation. So I hope you're right about that, though. And let me ask you, can we get hoisted on our own petard here? Because now we have a $20 billion plus budget and we are financially in good shape. Is this going to be too much of a temptation for the Republicans? I mean, why wouldn't Donald Trump and the guys on the Hill, the lovely people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lorena Bobart and the other people that hate us with a passion, why wouldn't they want control over that $20 billion? Do you think that's going to be too attractive for them to pass up?
No, I don't see that as the course of action, again, because the federal government's involvement in the past has always been based largely on the finances. And in that $21 billion budget that we have, $11 billion is locally raised and $10 billion is in the federal grant kind of situation. We get federal grants exactly in the same way that other states do. So we don't get a federal payment anymore. People, you remember that from way in the past. That's long gone.
So we are treated
like a state for all intents and purposes in the money that the city receives from the federal government. A lot of that is to Medicare and Medicaid, those, you know, the programs. And so we have that 50-50 match, et cetera, without going into a lot of detail. So I don't believe that the Congress will involve itself in that. They would be foolhardy to do that. They don't want to be running the city. I see the one area of vulnerability in the public safety arena, and because it's an easy one. And I think it's good to see that crime has come down. I think the mayor was saying 35% over last year. Still too high, but that's still a very positive achievement to see that kind of reduction. So I would make the argument if the president and or Congress starts moving toward the district that the district doesn't need management from the president and or the Congress. Now, there are things that I think the federal government could help us out on. And I'll just give you a list. If I were in charge, this is what I would do. I would go to the president and say, Mr. President, we need your help on some things. Okay? And starting right out of the box, we need the federal workers back at work. 320,000 people work for the federal government in the District of Columbia who don't come to our city anymore. When you look at some of those buildings, Department of Labor, 6%. Department of Commerce, you know, across from the Wilson Building on 14th Street, 3%. These places are ghost towns. And the president has said he wants people to come back to work. And I think he should order the federal government back to work. Now, the union is not going to like that. They've said they'll fight them on it. I would say you'd be lucky maybe to get 2/3 of the people back. But, Mike, that's 200,000 people working in our downtown that aren't there today. You know the terrible effect that has had on our downtown. So right out of the box, I hope he takes that action and gets federal workers back downtown. And then secondly, we have a lot of these federal buildings and buildings where the federal government is in that are privately owned. And the government can be helpful to us in making conversions. One of the things that I constantly, as the finance chair, had to deal with is our downtown, only 8% is residential, and the rest is commercial or other uses. It's the lowest residential composition of any major city in America. Most cities are around 20, 25, 30%. New York is around 30, 35% of people living in downtown. We just don't have that. And this may be our opportunity to get there, because it's a lot better having people live in downtown and work in downtown than it is having people commuting in from the suburbs. So I would, you know, err on the side of let's get some of these federal buildings and other buildings converted to residential. Now, that's hugely expensive. I got it. You know, I understand that better than most people do. But if the federal government can be helpful in doing that, then clearly, it's an approach that we need to take. And Donald Trump is, if nothing else, what is he? He's a real estate guy, right?
Yeah,
that's what he does.
That's true.
He wrote The Art of the Deal. So why not get him involved? And I'll tell you a little unknown story. When we were doing the convention center and back in the 80s, he wanted to come into the district and help develop stuff, and they kept him out. And, you know, I'm sure he's probably looking at, like, today, maybe this is my opportunity to get involved down here. So Pennsylvania Avenue between the Capitol and the White House. I mean, how many years have we studied that? It is a 9-lane highway, and there aren't any cars on it. You know, we want to turn it into the Champs-Élysées to get cafes there, to get, you know, life on that avenue. And he had a hotel there, so he knows what we're talking about. So how can we get some of those, you know, buildings that are just sitting there empty, you know, to have life and change Pennsylvania, put a lot of, you know, get rid of those 9 lanes of empty roads and put parks and restaurants, et cetera. And then, of course, the FBI building. Now, he has said clearly the FBI is not going out to Greenbelt. And I think that's, and maybe this is my opinion on that. I think that's good. We should keep the FBI in the city. It's 13,000 employees, for God's sakes. Why would we send them to Maryland? And if he wants to keep it in the city, you know, our opportunity now to develop that FBI building, to tear it down and put a mixed-use building there, maybe put the headquarters of the FBI, you know, the director and his or her staff there, but then build a campus elsewhere and keep it in the city. So I can go on about these things. I'll give you one last one. The Union Station. I mean, how long have we been studying Union Station? I mean, it's just years and years. And Trump is very familiar with Moynihan Station up in New York City, you know?
Yeah.
Let's get his involvement in these kind of projects to help our city. So take a positive approach on it and see if we can make some headway there.
Well, that I got to tell you, Jack's the most positive thing that I've heard said about this since the election, and I hope you're right about it. And the only thing I would add about crime is, just like the economy, you know, we understand, you understand as a warden-trained economist, that the economy is really not doing that badly. But for the average person, the economy, as you already pointed out, is the price of eggs, it's the price of gas, and it's the price of bread. It's not how the stock market's doing. It's not what unemployment is. And I would say the same thing about crime. You know, unfortunately, we've had a congressman carjacked. We just had another. We've had a somebody from the DNC murdered. We've had just recently had another staff person robbed on Capitol Hill, and the Republican staff person in the middle of the day. You know, we've had a lot of high profile crimes, which these guys can, I'm sure, will hold up. You know, part of our Achilles heel, and I know you know this, Jack, as somebody that's been long involved in Democratic politics, is we have no Republicans in Washington. Right.
Correct.
And people point that out all the time. We understand that statehood is strictly a partisan issue. For us, it may have something to do about freedom and justice. But for the Republicans, it's just two more Democrats in the United States Senate. Right. They don't want that. And they know that as solidly Democratic as we are, that that would be the case. And actually, our friend from Virginia, congressman who put together a bill to trade off Utah with D.C. for a vote, which you remember, that was the whole idea behind it, was that we could do a trade-off. And so I worry about that. But I hope you're right about all of that. And let's talk, you touched on this for a minute, but let's talk about this for a second. As a long-term council member, yeah, let's talk about some of the progressive policies. I was lambasted last year for saying that the council were acted like petulant children to send a crime bill up that they should have known was going to be rejected. Well, the mayor tried to veto the bill. They overrode the veto. They sent it up there anyway. We lost 44 Democrats, and they opened the door for these guys. And, you know, let's look at some of the other policies. Undocumented people in the District of Columbia can vote. Marijuana is legal. We have marriage equality. We have abortion on demand, needle exchange. And we just passed ranked choice voting, which I want to talk to you about ranked choice voting. But Trump didn't get 50% of the vote nationwide. So if we had ranked choice voting nationally, would Kamala have won? Would she have been the second choice for many people? I don't know how that would have worked. But anyway, we have all these progressive policies, and we've also embraced ideas like compensation for sex and protection for sex workers, 16-year-old vote. I could go on and on and on. But so what does the council need to do? There was an article in the paper today in the Washington Post about how they're trying to pull back on some of the legislation and rename it and make it look not so controversial. What do they need to do as a strategy going forward, do you think?
Well, I think going forward, I read that article as well, that sending controversial bills to the Hill, knowing full well that the Republican control of the House and the Senate is going to lead to them being shot down and the presidency, I would strongly advise the council not to do that. Even when they sent that bill up last year, my advice to them was to not do that because the chances are we were going to lose it. And the answer that came back to me was the president will never let that happen. And indeed, the president signed the disapproval and it got shot down. And I think the council didn't realize that they had put President Biden in a very untenable position by asking him to support something that no one in the country was going to support. So yeah, they have to be much more vigilant in their approach, you know, and not do things that are going to antagonize the Congress until we get a majority back down the road. As far as looking backwards, there was something published by somebody, and I'll read it to you. It says, I remember Charles Allen leading the charge for legalizing fare evasion. Jack Evans knew it was a horrible idea. He was chairman of the board of Metro, and he argued against it. And it says, on the dais, on the day of the debate, council members hashed out all of these arguments and more. Jack Evans, particularly impassioned, said he knew the measure was a feel-good thing that would probably pass, but insisted that the bill would be financially crippling to Metro, and the agency was already struggling with finances. And it proved, the person who wrote this said, it proved to be prophetic. Yes, it was financially crippling to Metro. They lost hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're still trying to dig out from it. You read somewhere that 70% of the people who ride the bus don't pay, and the fare jumping even now with the improved fare gates, people are still doing it. So we can't do things like that, and that sound good and feel good, but then have a detrimental effect. When we decriminalized a whole bunch of things across the board, that you can steal up to $900 from CVS and it's okay. That type of thing is just unacceptable. And you pointed out that even with the crime bill that the council passed recently, that this is still going on. You're right, because I have people come up to me all day. We just had two break-ins in Georgetown the other day.
Yep.
Smashes of the windows and people stealing stuff and robbery on the street and friend of mine said somebody got shot in front of his house over at Logan Circle. So we really have to restore some order. And I'll finish with this note again in dealing with the administration. If they want to be helpful in a way, we are down 700 police officers. We have 3,300 officers. We need 4,000. I was involved extensively in creating the police model that we have today that relies on 4,000 officers. Mayor agrees with this, but the council just can't seem to get there. And maybe, you know, we could get help from the federal government in getting more police. It's hard to hire them. I get it. Everybody's struggling with it. I get it. You can give me every excuse under the book as to why we can't get there. But in order to create a safer city, I truly believe that we are going to have to hire a lot more police officers to get control here. So we'll see. We'll see if that works.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, that's another thing. The council's got to take it on the chin for that a little bit, too, in that they changed the law about body cameras and stuff. And, you know, I've had Chief Ramsey on the show. I've had Chief Smith on the show. I've had Newsom on the show. I've had all these police chiefs on the show. And I ask them the same question. Why would you be a police officer in the District of Columbia when you could be a police officer in Montgomery County or Fairfax County and not have to deal with all the problems that you have to deal with in D.C.? It must be very, very tough for D.C. to recruit people. But one of my favorite things is the thing you mentioned, where they decriminalized gate jumping, fair jumpers, and then they've just turned around and recriminalized it, you know, a few years later, because they realized, like you said, that they were just losing tons of money, and Metro is trying to do whatever it can to survive here. And we also have a problem with the Metro Board, right? Because you've got people from Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. all on the board, and they all have competing agendas, and they all have different ideas of what they need, right? And the federal government, am I wrong about this? But they've never really stepped up to the plate, given the fact that on work days, the majority of the people on Metro are federal workers. But they've never really stepped up, have they?
No, you're absolutely right. Again, having chaired the board for 5 years over there, and I have a long history. I'd served on it in the 90s as well. So I did a lot of research into Metro. And on the positive side, the federal government built the system largely. When it started out, they were putting in two-thirds of the money, the federal government, and then the three jurisdictions were splitting up the other thirds, where we were putting in one out of every $6 from the jurisdiction. So it was a great program to get Metro built. It's a funny story in a way, because it was originally proposed to cost $1 billion, and it ended up costing $10 billion. But nonetheless, the 110-mile system got built. It's a great system. The downside of the system for the residents of the district especially is it's a commuter system. It's a spoken wheel system. It was built to bring commuters in from the suburbs and then take them back home. Hence, you don't have a stop in Adams Morgan, in Georgetown. So it's a real subway system like you would have in other cities. Right. But that can be fixed. You know, in the perfect world, you could build other lines like Paris does and accommodate everybody. But on the operating side, I do want to address what you said. On the operating side, the federal government and the people riding Metro are largely federal employees, pay zero, not a dime.
Right
now, Metro has a $3 billion budget. $1 billion is in the capital side, which the three jurisdictions pay, and $2 billion is on the operating side. $1 billion comes from the three jurisdictions. We pay about $350 million each. The other billion comes from the fare box. Well, now, instead of $1 billion coming from the fare box, they're bringing in about $200 million. That's the $800 million shortfall that Metro is facing right now. That should be picked up by the federal government. And that's the only argument I can make. The city doesn't have any more money they can give to Metro. Maryland is $3 billion in the red, for God's sake. They don't have any money. But the federal government does. I mean, I made the argument up there when I was chairman. We're America's subway. We're in the nation's capital. $1 billion to the federal government is a rounding error. They wouldn't even see what it is. And they should really put that into our system and make it a first-class system. That's the argument I would make. And all these congressional delegations we have, get them together. Get the four senators together and make it happen. So that's my pitch.
Well, and I think it's a good pitch. And I think, you know, maybe that's a positive note you take with the new administration is instead of persecuting the District of Columbia, why don't you show how to make the metro system great again?
Absolutely.
You know, and I got to tell you, when I worked my way through college and graduate school, Jack, working for a company that you would know very well, Britches of Georgetown. And
oh,
when
God.
I worked for Britches, in fact, I'm having a problem right now because I've just lost a tremendous amount of weight. I've lost 80 pounds. So I'm buying new clothes, but I'm buying more clothes than I need. You know what I mean? I'm about to retire, and I just bought four Brooks Brothers suits. And I said to my wife, because they were all on sale, I said, where the hell am I going to wear four suits? I'm retiring. But anyway, we lobbied against the Metro. We lobbied against the Metro. We didn't want the Metro in Georgetown because they were afraid that in the time that it took to tear up the streets to build the Metro, they would all go out of business. You know, there's a famous economist from Chicago, University of Chicago, who said, in the long run, we're all dead. And, you know, I kept that over my desk when I ran a small business because that is the mantra of small business, right? We're not Amazon. We're not Walmart. We can't plan 5 years in advance. We're only making it to the next quarter or the next pay period or the next, you know, whatever the short run is. So, we were very much against it. And it's a shame. When you go to cities like Chicago and New York, you see, even though the system may not be as nice, that it works much better because of that. Let me also ask you, since you have so much experience in finance, is there something that we can do? We're on pretty firm ground financially now. You think the city is solvent, and we absolutely need to bring back the federal workforce, do we not?
Yes, we need the federal workforce and as much of the private workforce as we can, get them back downtown again. Absolutely.
Right. Well, you know, I think about the fact that I have a dear friend who's a partner in Holland and Knight, a law firm
who has
amazing office space across the street from the White House, right? And they have two floors of this great office building, which must cost them a damn fortune. I don't know how much that must cost. But I think to myself, are they now thinking maybe we could do with one floor? You know, we've got all these people working from home, and, you know, maybe we can cut our overhead in half. And, you know, so it's going to be hard. What can we do to incentivize those people to come back, do you think, or to remain?
This is, law firms are a tricky one because that is one of our biggest industries are law firms.
Yeah, it really is.
I know them well, and I have good friends over at WilmerHale, over at Williams & Connolly, Holland & Knight, you mentioned. And a lot of them have gone to this 3-day work week, and I'm not sure they're coming back. Lawyers could must come in 3 days. They can't come in 5 days. They share offices, cubicles. They cut down on the amount of space they need. As their leases come up, they move to newer buildings. And it's a real problem because that's a huge part of our downtown workforce in that kind of service economy. I think what I'm hoping happens, and people begin to realize the value of in-person work product. And what I mean by that is, I am a lawyer, and I spent a good 40 years in large law firms in downtown Washington. And you learn a lot by communicating and being in the office next to somebody or being able to walk in and talk to the partner, whatever the situation is. And my daughter works downtown at AFSCME, a labor union down there, and they go in 5 days a week. And I said the best part about going to work is going out afterwards to happy hour and talking about your boss, right? I mean, that's the socialization that takes place. So maybe if the federal workforce comes back, that'll encourage the private sector to come back. And why is it important if somebody's listening to this? It's because those are the people who go and buy lunch in downtown. They go to the restaurants.
Yep.
They go to happy hour after work. They buy trinkets at the trinket stop. They get to go to the dry cleaners that happens to be around the block. They use the small businesses that are in our downtown that are now struggling or are just gone. And that is what creates this living downtown, which, again, goes back into my earlier comments. You know, I'd rather have people actually living downtown than commuting into my downtown, because if they live there, they're there 24/7, and they really will use our services. We have an opportunity, if we want to think big, to think about planning for the future of our downtown over the next 50 years. And I'll give you an example. Marion Barry and I stood together at Franklin Square. You know where that is. Franklin Park, they call it now, about 20 years ago. And Marion said to me, you know, the mistake I made is I should have made all of this residential all around the park. But he said, who in their right mind thought anybody want to live in downtown Washington? And life changed. People's, you know, approach to life changed. And just imagine if the three major parks, Franklin, Farragut, and McPherson, all had residential around them like New York City does, like the great cities of the world do. What a difference our city would be. So we have to use that as our model and then figure out how do we get there. I mean, we can't do it overnight, but everybody, somebody owns all those buildings and they need help. And again, going back to my conversation that we should be having with the president, is how can the federal government help us to convert these buildings and reimagine what our downtown should be? And this opportunity may not come again. And this is something we should really try and seize upon. To get there.
Well, you know, you bring up Marion and Marion Barry, of all the people on the DC council, Marion Barry was always the most generous and nice to me. I have, you know, like many Washingtonians, I think very highly of them, but unfortunately, you know, around the country, I never go out of, I've visited 17 states and I never go, to one of them that somebody doesn't bring up Marion Barry and the corruption that was, you know, and kind of the model he set up in D.C. What about that? You've got a guy in Ward 8 who's the council member, Trayon, and he was just – he's about to be convicted of bribery charges. Now, he has the right – to have a trial and you know before we trash them, but it doesn't look good. It looks like the FBI has got them. They have them on film. They have them asking for bribes and accepting bribes. But he was just reelected with 80% of the vote, Jack. 80% in Ward 8. What is that? That you know? I mean, that really is an Achilles heel for us, is it not?
Yeah, particularly at this time, again, as we talk about Trump and Republicans coming in to have a situation where one of your sitting council members is under federal indictment. So that's not a good look. What will happen, as I understand it, is the council commissioned an investigation that it's due next week, the December 15th.
That's
if
right.
If it comes back, as we think it will, that that the council member appears to be taking bribes, et cetera, then the council will have to act or not act. And if the council does not act, then that may not be the best look for them. So
can they act? I mean, isn't the voter supreme? You know, can they act? Can they? You know, because I know you can be convicted of all sorts of things and still run for public office, because when we set up the Constitution, right, we said the voters decide. You don't get to decide. The courts don't get to decide. The voters get to decide. So what can the council do? Can they
Well, the council can. They have three really remedies. And one is to censor the council member. They can reprimand, censor, and expel. Those are the three things. And
so they can expel.
Yeah, so the council, it takes a supermajority of 11 votes, but they can expel the you know, my observation as I sit here today is wait to get this report back, see what it says. If it's really, really bad, then the council will have to decide what's in the best interest of the voters in the city and whether to act or not act. But going back to Marion Barry, I'm with you on this, and I'm I've known Marion Barry a long time, and I was honored to Cora Barry, his wife, who I think is terrific as well, has just done a great job with the arts and with that center she has over the tennis center over in Ward 8, where, you know, I got to just say this about Cora. I mean, I've gone over there, and it is fabulous what she has done with the kids. She, you go there, and they have performances, they have learning. This city spends a lot of money, and sometimes I have no idea where it goes. But I got to tell you, that Ward 8 facility, you can see tangible results for all of the children in Ward 8 who are participants. So hats off to Cora. But she asked me to speak at his 10-year anniversary of his passing last week down at the building. We named the building after Marion, but also in the atrium, we have an entire history. I'd make a pitch for it. If you want to learn something about our city, and the Marion Barry times. It's not just about Marion. It's about the city, and Cora really wants people to understand that. And it's video. You go down there. It's quite impressive. But the stories we all told, and there was a panel of seven of us, Elijah Rogers, and, you know, a lot of people from the past were there. And Marion was really a legendary figure. And as someone pointed out, he never stole a dime from the city. And it's important for people to know that. He didn't take a dime from the city. I mean, he had his issues, as a lot of people do, you know. But he was really an inspiration for generations of particularly African-Americans in this city. I mean, half the people I run into got their first job at the Marion Barry Summer Jobs Program. Or they were in the Marion Barry Leadership Program, or they were the mayor, the student mayors, or whatever the issue was. He was very instrumental in that, and that's why. Do you remember? It was just a month ago. You know, I'm not a youth anymore, but when the ice cream store, the pizza place, called it Yes Pizza or something, and they made fun of Marion. Ron Moten, I'll give people a shout out. Ron organized and. There I am up on U Street, you know, protesting the pizza shop. but it, on a serious note, it's offensive for them to have taken a shot at us like that, taken a shot at Marion like that. And so it's unfortunate. You're right. When you travel around the world, people do know him, and it's sometimes not in a positive way. But I got to tell you, everybody knows Marion Barry. Isn't that amazing?
Right. And you know what? One of the greatest things about him is he was a great politician.
And
you know, I'll tell you just a really quick story. I went to an event one time when he was running, and they were talking about statehood, and they asked the candidates about statehood, and the first candidate gave a long, complicated answer, and the next candidate get a long, complicated area answer, and everybody was falling asleep in the audience. And I got to Marion Barry, and Marion Barry stood up and went, "Statehood." And people went, "Statehood." And he went, "Statehood." And they went, "Statehood." And so, 10 seconds into it, everybody in the audience was going, "Statehood, statehood, statehood." And I said to the guy next to me, "I feel like I should go up and say to the other candidates, that's how you do it, guys. Okay? You don't, you know, right?"
And right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And he had the ability to talk to you and make you think that there was nothing else in the world that was important to him at that moment other than what you had to say. And, he was a really, really kind person. He did have his foibles. Sometimes it's hard to defend him. But on a personal level, he was a great guy. Well, Jack, we got five more minutes, so I want you to say whatever I didn't ask you that you want to say.
Oh, well, thank you. And again, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure. And you've done a great job as our United States Senator. And I know you're stepping away from it, but your career over the years has been terrific. You've done your best on the Hill to represent us and really push the cause of statehood ahead. And so thank you. Thank you very much for your service. And, you know, hopefully you're not done with your service. You're just done with your job.
That's the thing, right? When you start volunteering for something, it becomes addictive, right?
Yeah, it sure does.
Right? ANC commissioner, so on and so forth. But go ahead. Tell us, what is it? How do you want to end this? Tell me what we didn't ask that you want to say.
Oh, well, I think you covered a lot. We've covered a lot. And again, going forward, I think the most important issue on people's minds, and there's a little anxiety over it, is what do we expect on January 20th and where do we go from here? Right. And I think the idea of reaching out, the business community, other communities, to the president and to Congress, and to seek their assistance, their advice, whatever we want to take the approach into how to make Washington a better city. Washington, D.C., and I gave this speech and continue to give it, we're the most dynamic city in America. Many of our institutions are the envy of places around the country. And I think we have a bright future ahead of us. One of the things we didn't talk about is getting our football team back. I know that it's stuck in Congress right now. The two senators from Maryland are not allowing the bill to go forward to transfer the land to the district in a shockingly, almost unexplainable article I read. They want our Air National Guard.
I know. I mean, it's crazy, right?
I had the opportunity when I was head of judiciary. I had oversight over the National Guard, and we have 20. Just so people understand, we have 20 F-16 fighters in our Air National Guard that patrol the city, and there are two of them on ready alert on a constant basis in case something happens. They can take right off. They have one that's a two-seater. It's a training plane, and they go up once a week. And I had the opportunity to go up in the back seat.
Oh,
and
wow.
So it was the ultimate carnival ride, to say the least, except when the pilot said to me, do you want to do a loop? Before I could contemplate what a loop meant, he did one. And I can tell you, when I got out of that plane, I was so sick.
Yeah.
But I think they do that to politicians to torture us. But going back to the football team, it's my hope that we can get that bill through Congress. Maybe President Trump can help us. He used to own the New Jersey Generals. He drafted Herschel Walker. You know, he's a sports guy. I'd love to get that done. And as I say to people in Maryland, you know, we're not trying to steal the Baltimore Ravens, for God's sakes.
You have a football team. You know, and the thing is that controversy is not over either. You know, once they get, if they get RFK back, there are people in that neighborhood that want a multi-use facility put. So it would still be a fight. But thank God we have a football team again, huh? I have to say that when I was 12 years old, I moved to Washington, D.C. My father took me into a bar, which you used to be able to do in those days. And I saw this chubby guy staggering out of the bar. And my father said, that's one of the world's greatest athletes. And I was like, what?
Sonny Jurgensen or something?
Yeah. And then I watched Sonny Jurgensen a few months later throw a 40 or 50 yard pass on a string to Charlie Taylor. And I was hooked. I've been a fan ever since. And finally, we got a football team back. We're still in the hunt for a wild card spot, and I hope that you and I both get to cheer for them back home sometime. So,
absolutely.
Jack Evans, thanks for being on the show. I hope all your children, I know you have three children,
three
right?
Three children, triplets, remember? Triplets.
Yeah, triplets. Oh, my God. You
They're
know,
28 years old now.
If you say that in front of any woman, they all go, oh, my God, three babies simultaneously. That would be... Yep. That would be it. I have three children, but we space them further apart. Well, I hope they're all doing good. Well, and
thank
the
you.
Evans family is going strong, and I will be personally offended if you and I can't have lunch again in the near future. So thanks so much for being on.
Absolutely.
And
okay.
We leave every show, we play it out with a song, and today this goes out to all of us that were disappointed in the election results that have to do as Jack Evans has pointed out so poignantly, try to get along with the future administration. Here's a classic song from ABBA, The Winner Takes It All. We'll see you next week. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.
to the people their right to vote.